The Comey Rule is a two-part series starring Jeff Daniels as former FBI Director James Comey and Brendan Gleeson as President Donald Trump. The series is based on Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, and tells the story of events surrounding the 2016 presidential election and the conflict that ultimately emerged between Comey and Trump. With me in studio this evening, Lise Hand, who has been watching The Comey Rule for us. And I know that you were probably dying to see this from the minute you heard that it was coming out, Lise Hand. I would pretty much guess.
You're not wrong.
I thought that, all right. Bring us back to the lead up to the 2016 presidential election. At this stage, really, we have Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as the two contenders. And the one thing the FBI are not supposed to do is open their mouths at all during an election year.
Precisely. And this miniseries is based on the memoir of James Comey, who was then the director of the FBI. And it actually opens, interestingly enough, with Comey sitting in the office with Barack Obama, who appointed him to the role, and they're having a discussion about how the sort of lines of demarcation must remain very clear between the White House and the sort of the machinery of government and the operations of the FBI. So that is the scene setter. And the action really begins then in July 2015. When it was announced that the FBI were opening an investigation into whether Hillary Clinton had improperly used an outside server for emails, very sensitive emails, when she was Secretary of State.
Yeah, she was using her own personal email rather than her gov.gov, whatever the address should be.
Absolutely. And we all remember that just immediately turned into an absolute and utter storm. I mean, but her emails and lock her up. A lot of that, you know, all the kind of the Trump supporters, that really stemmed from that announcement. So roll on a year, the FBI come out and say that there is no reason for the investigation to any criminal proceedings to arise out of the investigation. So far, so good. Then two weeks before the election at the end of November, another unrelated investigation into a former politician called Anthony Weiner. And just as a side note, if anybody ever wants to genuinely watch one of the most jaw-dropping documentaries from behind their hands, it's the one on Anthony Weiner in his 2013 run for New York governor. Anyway, his wife, Huma Abedin, worked for Hillary Clinton. She's one of her inner circle. Next thing, it looks like emails had bled from between Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin. And the whole drama of this is, should they reopen the investigation? At the very same time, also, there was the Christopher Steele dossier on on Russian collusion and on possible compromise against candidate Trump was also under investigation by the FBI. And there was a big question, should they go public with this? So
you have essentially what you have there is three big possible investigative lines.
Yes.
But that the FBI might follow. But the real complication here is the moral and ethical dilemma of talking about any of this in the lead up to a presidential election.
This is it. And, you know, this is slow moving. I mean, anybody expecting car chases and, you know, bombs going off and so on, I'm going to be sorely disappointed. But in a way, the sort of creeping horror almost of it is that you have a room full of people, investigators and various heads.
Brilliant minds, all of them.
Brilliant minds. And they are arguing ethical and moral implications of, you know, and you really, they really were sort of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea on this. And which we, the viewer, know that all those, you know, all those kind of hand-wringing and all the kind of ethical things would essentially be swept aside by the, you know, by President Trump, who just tore up the rule book and saw absolutely no problem in crossing those lines of demarcation whatsoever. And, you know, we're watching this with that sort of hindsight and watching the arguments unfold. And that's what sort of gives this sort of drama.
Yeah, well, let's listen to one of the this is a perfect example, I think, of the type of discussions that go on in the FBI room, where you have lawyers, where you have intelligence agents, where you have technical people who have huge knowledge of computers and all of the rest of it, and they're having discussions about what they should do. Amy Simons is the FBI lawyer here, Tricia Anderson, and she's questioning Jeff Daniels, playing the part of James Comey, whether the investigation that they're doing at the moment will lead to the election of Donald Trump.
What if our doing this results in the election of Donald Trump as president?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking it. Down that road lies the death of the FBI as an independent force in American life. If I ever start considering whose political fortunes might be affected by a decision, even for a second, we're done. You still disagree?
I know you believe in telling the truth. I do too. But there are all kinds of truths out there. We're also, for example, investigating the possibility that Trump's campaign is in bed with Russia.
But that's intel.
But it's a truth. And concealing one truth and publicly announcing another is selective honesty, isn't it?
Tricia, I told Congress and the country that this case was closed. If that's revealed to be a lie, how would they ever believe us again?
So there we have Amy Simons as Tricia Anderson, the FBI lawyer, and James Comey, or Jeff Daniels as James Comey, the director of the FBI in the lead up to the 2016 presidential election. This is part of the series, a two-part series, The Comey Rule. Lee's Hand watching it for us and with me this evening. Now, that for me, Lee, even as I listened to it there and I watched the first episode, I found it hard now to stick with the first episode. I wasn't expecting car chases, but I did expect a little bit of maybe West Wing speak where they'd flick me through the details that I need to know and then get on with the drama. It does really, what sound like the actual minutes from a discussion.
Absolutely.
They can't make up the words.
Well, they can't, and even the look of it reminds, there's a little touch of the kind of All the President's Men and sort of the sort of gloomy air and the sort of just the very basic offices with no frills and just the sort of sense of trying to feel the way through something that, these guys don't have the big picture. They have a corner of the jigsaw and the rest of the pieces are missing. And, this is, and a lot of that sort of deliberate, I suppose, tone as well comes from Jeff Bridges' portrayal of Jim Comey. And, there's a lot of discussion about, obviously, Jim Comey, was he a gullible fool? Mm. Was he genuinely upright and trying to preserve the traditions of the FBI? A lot of it hinges on, this, of course, is based on his own memoir. So obviously it's going to approach it from the point of view. So, he kind of plays it with this sort of very implacable face, sort of a deadpan face. But you get the impression, I think, that you're left with the overriding impression of a man who is completely out of his depth. I mean, he had sort of traded on a reputation of being a tough guy. When he was working in the New York office of the US Attorney General, he had been part of the prosecution team that had prosecuted the Gambino crime family. So, he had this sort of reputation and he brought that sort of, I'm after the bad guys mentality into the swamp. And really, the crocodiles were circling.
Well, what you've touched on it there, that they themselves, the FBI, Comey and his colleagues, were working with only a couple of pieces of the jigsaw in front of them. Is that still the case? Even though we're getting this, it has to be said, in the lead up to the current election, and I think it's pretty clear which side of the political divide we're going to get in this one. In the lead up to the 2020 election, do we still have enough of a picture to actually tell the story yet?
Well, you see, this is it. I mean, there was an element of too soon about this. I mean, I did sort of find myself kind of, wondering on sort of an intellectual sort of level whether it just was just too soon to actually parse and analyze and put the I suppose, the whole story into a kind of a context. I mean, it was a little bit like, do you remember the Brexit and Uncivil War that came out very soon after
the
Brexit,
Benedict Cumberbatch thing,
playing the Dominic Cummings and so on. Like, again, I had that sense that it was something that was sort of rushed out before the full picture had been
formed.
Yeah,
this is only chapter one.
This is sort of only chapter one. Yeah. And, you know, there is an element. I mean, it's interesting from the point of view that it sort of shows the cascade of events that happened, you know, particularly in the last few months leading up to it. And you sort of see the Russians, you know, the Russians are kind of there, kind of toasting each other, you know, looking down the mall.
Yeah, but aren't the Russians all, you know, kind of slightly pantomime villains swilling vodka and dressed in Armani suits?
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of going, you know, those foolish, you know, this was a moonshot and, you know, we've landed our guy. Then again, you know, it is a very complex story because, you know, you're trying to explain to people, you know, they kind of mention the sort of only the John Podesta kind of WikiLeaks dump only gets sort of mentioned. And that, again, was, you know, played into the sort of the anti-Hillary Clinton narrative, you know. And I mean, the thing is a bit, I suppose, one of the more dramatic scenes actually unfolds in the kitchen of the Comey household. And Jennifer Ely, who's actually wonderful. And I have to say, the cast is absolutely
superb. Amazing cast. I mean, who else?
Jennifer Ely. Holly Hunter is playing Sally Yates. Yeah. And, you know, and
Brendan Gleeson is there as
Brendan
Trump.
Brendan Gleeson, of course, as Trump. But Jennifer Ely is really good, you know, as his wife. And there's a great scene in the kitchen where herself and the two daughters are sort of really upset when it becomes clear that he's going to reopen the investigation 2 weeks before the election. Because, you know, they are just, as women, are particularly horrified by this.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip between Jeff Bridges again as Comey and Jennifer Ely as his wife. Patrice is the wife's name, isn't it? Patrice,
yes.
Comey.
Do you want him to win?
I can't talk about this with you anymore, Teresa.
Jimmy, what are you doing? Now, I would never ask you to prosecute someone or not prosecute someone in my life. I wouldn't do that. But you have four daughters. Now think about what it would mean for them to see a woman become president. Now think about what it would mean for them to see her lose to him. And you would have to live with that. And they would have to live with that forever.
Please don't make it seem like my choices are between loving my daughters or doing my job.
This is not your job. Swinging elections is not job.
But protecting the Bureau is.
No, you went there to put bad guys away. The Ramsey rapists of the world. Not to help them become president.
And that's Jennifer Ely there as Patrice Comey, Jim, and Jeff Bridges as James Comey. And that kind of, I have to say, that the family drama was the bit that worked for me. The, you know, the dilemmas around the girl, one of his daughters, is her first time to vote. And there was great family drama around that. But the other stuff was tough going.
It was. And it would have been probably better to see. I mean, I thought the interaction between you know, Patrice and James Comey was fantastic. And I think it was the one, it's almost like a parallel track. You had all these guys in the bubble, in the room, you know, looking at the hard data and the facts, and then you had what people really felt about the election, you know, the potential election.
And then I guess,
and the fact,
you know,
that James Comey, like, you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, played a pivotal role. I mean, you know, the polls did show that the, you know, revelations about the emails and the reopening of the investigation did have an effect. Now, how much, of course.
The writer, who's the writer, Billy Ray, says, oh, no, it wasn't pivotal at all. But that's, I suppose he would say that, wouldn't he? We have to finish up by listening to a little bit of Brendan Gleeson, who we see so little of in the first episode, it has to be said.
Well, this is it. I mean, there was a great quote, actually, from Billy Ray, who's the director and writer of it. And, you know, he was asked about the fact that that Donald Trump doesn't really actually appear until sort of 13 minutes into the second half of this. Mm. And he said that one of his favourite films was Jaws. And he said, you know, let's not see the shark until we have to, which is such a great quote. But he's there. And this is the whole thing. It's almost like, you know, it reminded me a little bit of, you know, Silence of the Lambs, and you're kind of going, don't go down to the basement, Clarice, because you know what's there. And you know he's in there and he's sort of lurking in the background, and you get the odd flash of him.
Right.
You see a meaty hand on the tender young sort of shoulder of a beauty pageant contest. And, you know, it's almost like you just get flashes of him.
Yeah, and you'll be waiting for episode two. You're dying to see episode two, are you?
Yes, I am.
But you need to know the politics. I think that's fair to say, isn't it? You need to know the backstories.
You do. I think it's sort of, this is the setup for the second episode. I think this is very much a setup. And, you know, Brendan Gleeson, we know what he's capable of doing in terms of character acting.
Hear it here. You mentioned that one of the early scenes is Comey in the Oval Office with Barack Obama. And then this is totally echoed by this scene, which I think comes in the second episode, actually, with Comey again speaking, this time in the Oval Office, I think, to President Trump.
Press has been very unfair to you. I know about that. Nobody gets treated as unfairly as I do. It's disgraceful. So I'd understand if you wanted to walk away, go back to the private sector. I know that's attractive, but I don't think it'd be good for you personally. It'd make you look like you've done something wrong. Who needs that? I mean, it doesn't matter to me that I can make a change. I get along with everybody. But I wanted to know what you were thinking about it.
It's true, Mr. President. You can fire the FBI director at any time for any reason or for no reason at all. But I want to stay because I love the Bureau and I love my job and I believe I'm doing it well.
One thing I never had to think about in the Trump organization because I did so much myself. You know, people think we were so big, but truth is I did everything. But now I have to rely on people. I have all these idiot advisors around who think they got me elected. You know, I actually listen to TV people because they got to get ratings every day. White House advisor can guess wrong, still keep his job. Not the TV guys. A lot of smart people in that business.
Well, you can rely on me, sir, to tell you that...
I need loyalty. I expect loyalty.
Brendan Gleeson as President Donald Trump and Jeff Daniels, it is actually, I think I misnamed him a couple of times, Jeff Daniels playing the part of James Comey there in The Comey Rule. Lee's Hand talking to us about that two-part series available from tomorrow on Sky Atlantic, the streaming on the streaming service Now TV. Cork Folk Festival kicks off tomorrow, Wednesday, runs through until this Sunday, October the 4th. And as with all recent festivals, it's been reimagined for the times we live in. But the organisers are still bringing audiences over 20 concerts, which will take place behind closed doors, along with launches, guided walks and workshops. Amongst the performers at this year's festival is Kildare singer and songwriter Aoife Scott, whose album Homebird was released earlier this year. Talk to Aoife in a few minutes' time after we hear the title track from that album, Homebird. Homebirds, the title track there from Aoife Scott's latest album. And Aoife is one of the artists performing at this year's Cork Folk Festival, which begins tomorrow Wednesday, continues through until Sunday. Aoife, I had to double check myself there when I said Kildare singer Aoife Scott. But that kind of
John,
fits.
I was kind of panicking there a little bit when you said that. I don't think anybody in Kildare is going to be happy with that. No, I'm a massive dub, but I am living in Kildare. And that's what that song is about.
Yeah, so, well, that's what it leads us into telling us what Homebird and why Kildare is kind of providing you with the inspiration for Homebird at the moment.
Yes, very much so. I mean, Kildare is a beautiful county and we were locked down here and we were very lucky to live in this beautiful house that I'm in right now. Basically, when I was writing my second album, which is the title track of that second album is Homebird, we were in this house and I kind of took some time off, but it this house and this area transformed me into a different person. I mean, I moved from Dublin city centre, from being from the Liberties into the middle of the countryside, and that was a huge shock, but in a good way. And it shocked me into really taking in my surroundings and very much been obsessed with looking at birds and bird watching. So it became such a thing for me that I just wanted to write a song of gratitude as to where we were living and how lucky we were to have found a little house to hole up in after coming home from tour. And we're very lucky.
Yeah. And I don't think Kildare will have any problem with you kind of taking it on as your adoptive county. And in case, and if you have trouble there and you can't go back home to Dublin, Love Aoife Scott says this text: her gigs are full of life and fun. Her live streams kept me company during lockdown. I wish her every success. She deserves it. Aww. A fan from the Banner County. So Clare could be next if you're stuck for somewhere. I was interested, Aoife, you know, obviously this thing with festivals and having to go online, we've had a lot of it in recent times. I was interested in something that you said about this. People are always talking about, yeah, the absence of an audience, is that's a huge thing. You spoke about, or I saw you making a comment around, it's your relationship with the songs has suffered as a result of not having been able to perform them in front of an audience.
I mean, Homebird, the album came out in January, and so we were just launching like it on a kind of a tour in February, and then March we were in America when the lockdown happened. And so I have all these relationships with these songs like they're my children, you know. And I also have to tell the story about it, you know, and it is part of who I am. And I had been gigging them every night, and all of a sudden then that was taken away from me, and being able to communicate the song and the story to everybody was gone. And I really felt the loss of not being able to do that anymore. It just felt so strange. So I think in a way, live streaming definitely helps. It's not the same, but you can still be able to tell the same story and tell it in a different way and sing it in a different way, because every night people react, and it's a medium of communication. Like the way I see it is when I'm singing to an audience and they're picking up what I'm trying to tell them, and I'm a storyteller in that sense. So the song in itself is a story, but also the story behind it, which is what I tell. Like, I mean, I talk half of my gig as well. So you can imagine I like my talking. Yeah. But so in that sense, I really missed it. And I felt the loss massively. And it was just like all of a sudden, these songs I was talking to and talking about and singing to and singing about were stopped and paused. And I felt that really. Yeah, it was huge.
But is the live streaming aspect of it, I think that's quite important too, isn't it? That you actually, you are performing live. So there is still that slight danger, albeit in front of a camera as opposed to in front of an audience. But I mean, that's the same as being on radio or being on television, where you can't necessarily see the audience anyway.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, when we started to look at, I mean, everybody and every single musician in the world has now started to look online as to the way to they can reach their audience. And for us, we always said that we didn't want to do a pre-record, that everything that we were going to do was going to be live, because that's what the element is you're reaching into people's homes. They're seeing this happen live. If something goes wrong, if you make a mistake, you know, they're seeing all of that. It's the same as doing a live show, you know. And if your internet decides to die or you get a power cut, there, you know, that's
you have to
what
deal
happens
with it. Yeah,
it is, and that's what's amazing about the live streaming.
And
where
will you be doing that live streaming? What venue are you in for it?
We're in Keno on Sunday at the Cork Folk Festival, but there's actually tickets being sold for that, for live in person tickets is what we're saying, because it's hard to differentiate the live stream tickets and the tickets, you know, because everything is an online event these days. So there's actual in person tickets, and there's in person tickets for a lot of events at Cork Folk Festival over the weekend, but they're all obviously socially distanced and a lot more reduced. I mean, it's down to 45 people, and you know, we're trying to be very responsible and bring music back to people, but also, you know, do it in a safe way.
And I guess those 45 people or whatever, and obviously, as you say, it will all be done within whatever restrictions will be in place and are in place at the time, obviously, done safely. But it's very exciting for them to be. I was part of a small audience at a theatre show in the Kilkenny Arts Festival, and you kind of feel it special in some ways. There's only 20 of us out there. I can't remember what was there. I think it was 20 or 30 at the time. That gives it a kind of an added intimacy.
Do you think so?
I mean,
I'm still getting my head around it, to be honest, because we did a gig in Donegal last week and it was sold out, but the sold out is still half the room, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm missing the rest of the bodies in the room a little bit. And so I haven't been in a gig where I'm watching it from a social distance. We're all kind of separated and it is a much more intimate affair. I haven't been that person yet watching the show. So it's interesting to hear your side of it, because I'm still trying to get my head around the the, you know, people being further away from you as well, because obviously you're trying to keep your socially distant from the audience. And that's, and one of the major things for me after the show is that I can't hug people. That's really terrible. But I hug all these strangers because I just feel like a connection with them. They're already my friends after the show, and I really miss them. That's one of the things that you do miss. But sure, we'll get over it anyway.
All right. So are there new songs being written in Kildare, or what is the current state of play?
Yeah. Very excited, Sean, about a new song. We're going to release it now in October. And we just had Ron Block, who produced the album Homebird. He recorded on this as well. And we have Barry Bales, and they're both in Alison Krauss and Union Station's band. And it's the first time, because, you know, I'm a tortured artist, one of those people that doesn't like listening to myself at all. But this song in particular that we're really excited about releasing in October, I like listening to it, which is a good sign, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, listen, and you might, you know, you won't give it a whiz at the gig in Cork, will you? No.
I might sing it, yeah. I might sing it for a few lucky people.
All right, for the lucky ones that are there, even though you think there's three empty seats between those two people, they're thinking, wow, I'm here with Aoife Scott, just the 45 of us. Listen, thanks for speaking to us this evening, Aoife.
Thanks for your
And best luck with all coming. Gamina Maghat Freshen. That's Aoife Scott there, and she will be performing at the Keno venue on Washington Street in Cork this Sunday, October the 4th. The concert will be streamed live as part of the Cork Folk Festival. Kicks off tomorrow, runs until this Sunday. And as Aoife said, you can get tickets for the event as well. Corkfolkfestival.com will give you the details there. And we should also mention as well that on Sunday night, which is the last night of the festival, that's October the 4th, TG Cahir will begin a six-part series entitled Cork Folk Festival at 40. And this will be presented by Dylan Ní Chlacán. Run each Sunday at 9:30 p.m. on TG Cahir through until November the 8th. And they will showcase specially recorded concerts from last year's Cork Folk Festival. And amongst the artists there, Aero Lennon, Steve Cooney, Artie McGlynn and Eliza Carthy. But do check out corkfolkfestival.com for full details on this year's festival. And so to Where Do I Begin? This week we would shine a light on the work of a singer whose virtuoso vocal stylings have made her loved and hated by millions over the course of her decades-long career, with 15 studio albums and critically acclaimed and panned acting roles under her belt. Mariah Carey is a truly iconic recording artist who is just as responsible for inspiring singers like Beyoncé and Christina Aguilera as she is for providing songs for singers with perhaps a little less talent to perform on The X Factor. Her memoir, The Meaning of Mariah Carey, is published today, and Louise Bruton is with me in studio this evening to assess the impact of her career. An eight octave vocal range is the first thing you have to talk about when you talk about Mariah Carey. It's an astonishing voice and instrument, as they would say, that she has, Louise.
Yeah, she pretty much hits them all. And I think that when she first came along, she was immediately kind of in the shadows of Whitney Houston. And when, like, all the kind of record labels, when they saw her, they're like, this is our opportunity, this to have the next Whitney Houston. And she kind of started out in that sort of clean girl image, who is singing kind of lovey-dovey songs, big ballads. But it kind of, as she kind of leant into that, you could see that she was just she was able to do like a dog whistle, which not everyone should attempt. Some people do, but she goes for it.
Well, you know, let's hear a dog whistle, or it's a little bit more melodic perhaps than a dog whistle. This is Dream Lover. In about 30 seconds in, mind the glasses and the press. From Mariah Carey, and that's from her album Music Box from 1993. Louise Bruton asking the questions, where do I begin with Mariah Carey? In fact, the first thing that you want us to begin with is, yes, there's the vocal range, which is you must comment upon. Yes, she has a bit of a reputation as a diva, but you're saying there's a cultural impact involved with in Mariah Carey's case that we shouldn't overlook.
Well, the thing is, when she kind of first burst on the scene, like I said, she was marketed as the white Whitney Houston. Mariah Carey is actually, she's mixed race. And this was something that she kind of found quite difficult to approach earlier on in her career because she was being marketed as this blonde singer with this incredible vocal range. And she could never be placed into one category. So she was placed more pop, but she wanted to be more R&B. And when she first came on the scene, she was actually married to the head of Columbia Records, who was Tommy Mottola, who wanted to keep her as the pop balladeer. And there was kind of like a fight for control throughout her career because she was young. She was about 23 when she married him and he was in his early 40s. And as she wanted to kind of experiment with more kind of R&B and urban music, he was kind of putting the foot down saying that, no, this wasn't something that she should do. But with the success of Dream Lover, which was veering a little bit more towards R&B, and then she went on to collaborate with a lot of hip hop acts, she then progressed her own success even further, proving that it wasn't just ballads what people wanted, it was kind of a cooler edge. And she proved then that she probably knew what was better for her than what her label.
She took a bit more artistic control, but she had had success even before Dream Lover, Music Box, Dream Lover on that album in 1993. She'd had success in 1991 at the Grammys.
Oh, she's huge success. The Vision of Love was her debut single, which was released in 1990, and that was one of those songs. I think it's in the top 40 for something like 11 weeks. It was a song of 1990 that everyone grew sick of because it was just everywhere. It was one sound that she kind of had, but then as she moved on, she has an ear for kind of different sounds, different samples. So when she kind of got into the production seat, she was always a songwriter. She always had the lead songwriting credits on her tracks. But as she got into the production seat, she was able to reach out to a younger artist, and she actually created what is now continuously in the charts, which is the pop hip hop collaboration. So when she worked with like Old Dirty Bastard and Puff Daddy and Q-Tip, all these massive hip hop icons, she kind of married these two genres together, which kind of gave her more credibility, but also gave a lot of the hip hop acts bigger entry into the charts.
A little bit more marketability, I suppose. It worked very well. A symbiotic relationship, exactly. I think we might refer to it as. Now, 1993, we've had a track from Music Box, in Dream Lover that we just heard there. Obviously, 1994 saw the Christmas album. I know it's nearly October, but we might just put that to the one side for the time being.
Hugely successful, we know. Yeah, we know that.
And we will hear plenty of it in the coming months. But let us go on then to 1995 and Daydream. 1995 is her year, I think you're saying.
1995 was the year that she was just everywhere. That was when she had Fantasy, which again, this shows like her sampling kind of finesse, where she sampled Genius of Love by Tom Tom Club. Tom Tom Club's Genius of Love. And then she fought to have Old Dirty Bastard collaborate on the remix, which again, against the head of her label, he just decided that this was not the direction for her, but she made it happen.
So Fantasy, you would say, was this kind of her laying down a bit of a marker? This is what I want to do. This is how I want to mix hip hop and the big pop ballad.
I think it proved that she was more than just a product. It was something where she could actually change the charts, which she had done previously, but she was now kind of laying down the taster for what other acts would continue to do in the future.
Well, let's have a listen to Fantasy then from that 1995 album, Daydream. And that's Fantasy from Mariah Carey, about whom we are asking the question, where do I begin with Mariah Carey? Louise Bruton doing the honours for us on this Tuesday evening. I was asking you as we were listening to that, I mean, you can hear the kind of the beat of a hip hop song there for sure, but she hasn't quite plucked up the courage to go into total rap mode. Does she get to there later on?
She does get there later on. So she's still very firmly kind of in the pop bracket because at this stage, she's still married to Tommy Mottola. But when she divorces him, which is in 1997, she then kind of asserts more control. And it's a timeless narrative that a lot of pop acts follow when they suddenly kind of break free from a certain label, like or kind of management. Yeah. Like I'll use Janet Jackson as an example. When she broke free from her father's management, she suddenly released kind of genre defining yeah. music. And then that's what Mariah Carey eventually did when her divorce from Mottola in 1997 kind of led her onto a new chapter in her career, which was collaborating with Puff Daddy. And just really her vocals then were less big songbird, but more kind of a cool kind of edge to her.
Well, I know I have your favourite up on the cart wall on the screen in front of me, and I will come back to it, I promise, before the end. But since we've kind of moved on a little bit into that, you know, into that later part of the career, what about Butterfly then? The album here was Butterfly 1997, wasn't it? And we have a track called Honey from that. Is this where we're seeing much more of the individual?
Certainly, because she was plucking people that she wanted to work with who she knew would improve her sound. Because,
like whom? What sort of people were involved here?
But this was definitely kind of rappers, so hip-hop, acts like Q-Tip and Puff Daddy. But previously she had worked with Jermaine Dupri, who would be one of the biggest kind of R&B producers, but she first collaborated with him and then he went on to have a massive career. So she's one of these kind of perfectionists who was always in the studio. And when she was recording this track, Honey, with Puff Daddy, she apparently refused to record with him in the room because she found him overbearing. And she did 100 takes herself, sent him 100 takes. And it's just this kind of perfectionism because she changed her vocal style incredibly here. So instead of going for the big diva, she kind of retracts it. It's kind of a more level of control and kind of coolness to her.
All right. Honey from Butterfly album from 1997 and Mariah Carey. Puff Daddy, you could almost give him a little hug and a cuddle there with his little, I like that. It's very, very soft version of Puff Daddy, isn't it?
I'm sure that's what he was going for.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like that. That's his forte, it has to be said. He has a whole other career apart from his collaboration with Mariah Carey. Subsequent to this though, Louise, things did go a bit pear-shaped in 2001 particularly.
So 2001 was when she made her acting debut in a film called Glitter, which had an accompanying soundtrack with it. But the film and the album were released on September 11, 2001. Yeah. So it was a commercial failure on both accounts. But it was also when things in her personal life were coming to the surface. She was becoming a little bit erratic in public appearances. Mm. And she did have to kind of seek treatment for like mental and physical exhaustion.
And when did the Essence magazine, wasn't she on the cover of Essence magazine, which kind of established her credentials as a mixed race woman? Or not as her credentials, but others accepted her credentials as a mixed race
woman. It wasn't until 2005 when she landed her first ever cover on Essence magazines, which is celebrating kind of black artistry. Mm. And the cover of that read, America's Most Misunderstood Black Woman, because everyone said that she was a white girl with a black woman's voice, but she never really was able to kind of identify clearly with where she stood on that. And it's actually only now, as she's releasing her book, that she's fully addressing kind of her discomfort with how she was projected.
Let us go back then to, I think, what is your favourite song, or one of your favourite songs of Mariah Carey's, Always Be My Baby, and tell us why then has she become such an adored figure in popular culture, and I'll set this song rolling as you start telling us.
I think that Mariah Carey is definitely kind of one of those legacy artists where we're probably only now, with the kind of hindsight of everything that she's achieved in her time, that we're going to just see how involved she was in her career, and not just in what she did, but it was what other people did following what she did. So she is definitely responsible for the likes of Beyonce and Christina Aguilera, and for the likes of kind of like Jennifer Lopez to come along and be a pop act, but in a hip hop world, because that's exactly what Mariah Carey did.
And here she is with Always Be My Baby from Dead Dream album from 1995.
Always be mine.
Always Be My Baby from Mariah Carey's 1995 album Daydream. And it was Louise Bruton who was asking and answering the question tonight, where do I begin with Mariah Carey? I suppose if we have a Machu Picchu in Ireland, a place of beauty and contemplation while being extraordinarily remote, it's the Skellig Islands off the coast of Kerry. These rugged outcrops are literally on the edge of the world. And if the physical location and rugged texture aren't dramatic enough for you, then there's the history as a home to a group of up to 13 hermit monks between the 6th and 8th century who created structures that still exist today. Don't take my word for it, of course. Ask J.J. Abrams, who set one of his most dramatic Star Wars scenes ever on Skellig Michael or Skellig Vihil. The islands are notoriously difficult to reach, and there's a cap on the number of visitors who can visit, which is just one of the attractions of a new book of photographs, The Skelligs, Islands on the Edge of the World, offering, as it does, never before seen sights of Skellig Vihil and its accompanying island as well. The creator and photographer, Peter Cox, is responsible for the book and he joins me now. Obviously a very beautiful location, a remote location too, it has to be said, Peter, and it, a lot of commitment, I would have thought. Was it 10 years you spent travelling back and forth to get the pictures that eventually made their way into the book?
That's right, Sean. Thanks for having me. Yes, 10 years of a project, which in order to get photographs that really are something a little bit different and maybe above sort of the standard that you'd normally see is, and again, given the remoteness of the island, it's sort of par for the course, I think.
And describe exactly what we're talking about here. How many islands, and are we talking about islands and rocks, or are they all defined as islands separately?
That's a good question, actually. I think you definitely Skellig Michael or Skellig Vihil, as you call it, as you say, and the small Skellig or Skellig Beag would be classified as islands. And then there's also Lemon Rock, which is the sort of the poor unloved child of the three of them, which is between Skellig, small Skellig and the mainland. And it's also actually had its share of Hollywood history. In fact, Dumbledore and Harry stood on it under the Cliffs of Moher, mind you, in one of those movies. So that shows movie magic for you.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're magicians. Of course they could do that. That's wizardry can allow those type of things. Was there a particular moment when the Skelligs became important for you, Peter, or that they really struck you as something you wanted to pursue as a photographer?
I've always been very attracted to remote places and islands in particular. And I remember the first time I saw the Skelligs, it was actually in from Dingle. I was visiting a friend down there, probably, I don't know, 20 years ago plus now. And I saw these jagged islands off on the horizon and I'd never heard of them. So I decided to do a little looking. And the more I read about them, the more interested I became. And was then and still is very difficult to get out to them.
Yeah.
So it wasn't probably until, I don't know, 12 or 13 years ago that I finally first got out onto the islands.
Yes, I've had more than one experience where you have a ticket ready and you're told, well, yes, if the weather permits. And on two of the three occasions, I think the weather didn't permit in my case. But I did get onto them once, which was an amazing experience, I have to say. Obviously, their physical beauty and physical maybe brutality in some ways is very striking, even from the coast. But what about the presence of the Christian monastery near the summit of Skellig Vihil itself? How important an aspect of that was that for you as a photographer?
Oh, very important. It's the monastery and the monks and the story of what they achieved. Of course, we don't actually know directly from them, what life was like on the island, because there's no writing left from a Skellig monk. It's all been lost. So we can only infer from what we see. But certainly the structures that are there are just incredible. And, I've titled the book Islands on the Edge of the World, because these monks, for them, it was almost quite literally the edge of the world. You know, here be dragons would be what would have been on the maps out past them. So the monastery itself is just a remarkable feat. As you're approaching it from the boat, as you come in from the east, you look up at the lower peak, which is where it is, and it looks like a fortress because there's this huge wall facing you. And of course, when you're in the monastery itself, the wall is only about waist high. It's a massive retaining wall because they had to build these huge terraces even before they could start building the cells and the beehives that are there.
I know when you think of just the sheer logistics of all of that, we're talking about no flat space whatsoever. Like basically, they're on cliff edges almost all of the time on the island. No water. Very difficult to see how they even made it as habitable as they did make it.
Absolutely, and one of the things that tells the story really is that, something very simple, but at the base of what's now the main access steps, which is the south steps that go up to the monastery, you get there by the lighthouse road, which was put there by the lighthouse builders in the 19th century. But below that, the original start of those steps is still visible, and it's carved into the rock in the intertidal zone. And you can just imagine the work and the effort, their land and off their curraghs or whatever they would have had at the time, the Navogues, and chipping away with chisels into this rock. And that's just the beginning of the whole enterprise.
Now, one of the things that is really striking about the book is the time of day at which you took these pictures. I mean, some of the skyscapes are just stunning. So you wanted to, I suppose you were trying to give us a different view from, from the general view that we would get of the Skelligs.
That's true. So most people, obviously, that get out to the islands, and of course, there are fewer that get onto the islands than want to get onto them. They get out there, in the middle of the day in the summertime, which is visually, the islands are fantastic, but photographically, that's not the best time to be capturing them. And of course, when you're out there with 200 other people, you have a hard time excluding those people from your photographs. So what I, my whole, the philosophy behind my photography is always to convey some sense of awe that I feel when I'm in a place and get that feeling of majesty and convey that to the viewer. And with the Skelligs, because they're so inaccessible and because the access to them is so restricted in terms of when you can be there, I really wanted to show people things that they would never ordinarily get the chance to see, that very, very few people in history have ever seen out there on those islands.
And so you chose difficult times of day for yourself to make your trip there. The aerial photographs, were they done from some sort of flying craft, I'm guessing?
Yes, they would have been done from helicopter or from a drone outside of the bird season.
And the birds, you don't give us any, or very few that I can see at any rate, no pictures of the birds. Did you want to keep it as a pretty, there's one or two in the, that you can see if you zoom in really on some of the pictures. But did you want to really give us a sense of this uninhabitable and currently obviously uninhabited place?
Yeah, I suppose it's the physical landscape and the human story of the islands that really interests me. And of course, there's a significant wildlife story there with the birds. And there is a nod to it. There are a couple of pictures of puffins toward the end of the book. You can't not go to the Skelligs and not photograph puffins. But it's really the human story, the story of the monastery, the story of the lighthouse builders, and then also just the sheer physical beauty of the book. And of course, you kind of have to stop somewhere. If you try to do too much, it gets fairly bloated.
I don't know if you remember this one specifically. If I describe it, perhaps you will. I'm on page 52 of the 65 page book. It's the one with the very, very red sky. It's almost there's either a storm brewing or it's just a beautiful sunset with the beehive huts in the foreground, and then this really dramatic sky behind. This was the type of view, I guess, that you wanted us to have that we don't normally get.
Absolutely. And and the very limited time that I had on the island, getting a sunrise, indeed it is a sunrise like that,
yeah,
is something that is rare enough. Seeing that really fiery red sunrise is something you don't see very much in Ireland, and I was incredibly lucky to be able to get that. In fact, that morning when I woke up, I nearly didn't go up to the monastery because it looked like it was just going to be completely clouded over.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was, but there was that little gap over on the horizon that let the sun through.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's exactly the kind of... Yeah.
Think that you were to the red sky in the morning, the shepherd's warning, but clearly the photographer's delight. What about Star Wars then? What was your feeling on the Skelligs being used in the way they were used in the Star Wars movies?
I mean, obviously, whenever you see something that you're familiar with used in a big production like that, it's always a little bit of a thrill. I think it has been a mixed blessing, very much so. It's made it harder to get to the islands for people that want to get out there for the important reasons, if you like. But on the flip side, then, it broadens the awareness of the islands, and the people that do go out there interested in Star Wars, they then can also learn about the islands and appreciate them in their own right.
All right. Well, listen, it's a beautiful publication and the pictures are so dramatic. One quick mention of the maps that are all over the book as well.
Yes, there's a 19th century map that I got permission to reproduce from the National Library. And it gives you a sense of context of each of the spreads and where each of the photographs is taken. And what's wonderful about it is that even though it's a 19th century map, the island really hasn't changed.
Hasn't changed since, yes. Nothing's changed from those maps. Well, that's Peter Cox speaking to us there about his publication, The Skelligs, Islands on the Edge of the World. Self-published, available from his website, which is petercox.ie. €29.95 is what you will get that book for.